not start, but we're going to do things until we start. We haven't got a quorum yet, but we have quite a bit of material to go over today. We're going to talk today about some waiver services. If they want to come down and just get settled, Charity Flohn and Andrea Zuber, is that? Talk about waiver programs. Do you have a quorum yet? No. And then also, I ran across this article, this thing called the Hot Spotters. I don't know if anybody you saw this. This is a fascinating article. And it's like, well, why don't we always do this kind of thing? It talks about looking after geographic concentrations of people that, by coincidence, seem to use a lot of services. And I think that we're going to talk about the CCDS's Thursday. And I think some of what they learned is what they've learned here. And there's a lot of good ideas that point the same direction. So that's just for your enlightenment. Have the quorum. We'll come to order. Who wants to? Representative Anderson would like to move the minutes. Any discussion about that? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Oh, anybody against them? I don't want to hear if you're against the minutes, I guess. So they're adopted. And so today we're going to hear about some waiver information from the county point of view. Thanks for coming back. I'm sorry we had to bump you. It's just always good to come here and hang around and get to see people. And I know some of you came from a distance, so I appreciate that. And then we're going to talk about non-emergency transportation for the second half of the time. And so we've got about 30 minutes on the waivers. And so you know that. And so we're going to just limit our discussion to that amount of time, and hopefully there'll be time for questions. So welcome to the committee, and introduce yourselves. However you're going to organize your presentation, it's nice you're here.
Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Andrea Zuber, and I work with Ramsey County Community Human Services, and I'll let you introduce yourself.
I am Charity Flohn. I'm the Director of Human Services for Steele County. So we'll kind of be, Andrea's going to go first, and then I'll follow up.
Great.
So in Ramsey County, we support almost 6,000 people with disabilities through our disability services area. And that would support people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and then also people who use the CAC, CADI, and TBI waivers. Those are people who have traumatic brain injuries, physical disabilities, mental health issues, or significant medical support needs. I've been asked to testify today on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Counties, and there's a handout in your folders that I'm loosely going to work off of, but it's more for your reference than anything else. What I've been asked to do today is actually just walk you through. When someone comes to our door in need of services, what does that look like? How do we assess the person's need, and then how do we set them up with services that meet their needs? So as you can see, eligibility is a bit different for each waiver. There are some similarities, but there's also some differences based on the type of disabilities that people have. And then similarly, our intake, assessment, and case management look a little bit different for those types of services based on disabilities. But I'm going to try to walk you through as general of a picture as possible. So when someone calls, we go out to their home and we do a screening or an assessment of needs. There's a couple tools that are generated by DHS, by the State Department, that we use to do those assessments. And the purpose of that initial screen is really to get a picture of the person's needs and determine if they're eligible for county-administered services. So if they are eligible for county-administered services, a case manager is assigned, again, based on the type of disability. So they would either have a case manager who works with people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, or they would have a case manager who administers those other three waivers, the CAT, CADI, or TBI waivers. The case manager gets out to see people within 10 days, and then from there they work really closely with the person and their family to get a deeper understanding of what their needs are, match them up with the services and supports to meet those needs. They develop a community support plan or an individual support plan, which lists out what that person's goals are, generally to live as independently as they possibly can in the community, and then what supports and services need to be in place for the person to meet those goals. For the CAC, CADI, or TBI waivers, the screener who goes out and does that initial assessment comes up with an initial recommendation for a safe plan of care for that person. And it has the type and the amount of services that they're recommending just from that one snapshot in time where they met the person and did the initial assessment. So the case manager would use that as a starting point, but then would really talk with them, find out really what types of supports are available, providers, talk to them about, you know, self-directed supports. If it's somebody with an intellectual or developmental disability, they are assigned a DD case manager. Developmental Disabilities Case Manager. It's called Rule 185 Case Management. And then that case manager will go out and assess whether or not they're eligible for a DD waiver. So they might get a DD waiver, or they might just have other types of services that the case manager connects them with. So based on their assessed needs, the case managers figure out what types of services make sense for people. Then the other piece that comes into play is allocating the funding and determining how much of those types of supports somebody might need. So if somebody has a plan of care that says that they need to have support living in their apartment, living independently, and they need employment supports, those would be the services. And then how much of that do you authorize? And in Ramsey County, we use a needs-based funding methodology to allocate those funds. It's based on their assessment, on their screening document, and they have either an in-home budget that supports people if they're living in their own apartment or if they're living with family, or they have a placement budget if it's somebody who's looking for corporate foster care, and then they get a vocational services budget. And that needs-based budgeting has been in place in Ramsey County for about 10 years, and it's worked really well for us because we really feel like we're supporting people exactly at their needs. We're in the process of developing a similar tool for the other waivers for people with the CAT, CADI, and TBI waivers. But as part of our state waiver plan, we have what's called approval and purchasing guidelines, and that's really what directs the case manager to figure out how much services to put in place for somebody based on their assessment and what their needs are. So once the person has their budget, the case manager works with them and their family to choose providers who will meet their needs or set up a consumer-directed community support plan so that the family can direct their own services with informal supports. The case manager also does ongoing quality assurance monitoring, ongoing assessment, and information and referral. And we also have a team of administrators that meets on a weekly basis to review requests for increases to waivered services, new requests, set budgets, and prioritize needs. In Ramsey County, we are really focusing on helping people build their own social capital, their own informal networks, and to incorporate the use of informal supports as much as possible to meet people's needs. We really have seen a lot of nice success when families are able to direct their own services and those types of supports. And consumer-directed supports also seems to be what really works well for people who have linguistically or culturally specific backgrounds. We have worked really hard to bring on providers who have language capacity or who are culturally specific, but we're still working within a common service menu of service descriptions. So it's nice for families to be able to kind of be flexible and direct their own care that way. So I'm just going to give you a couple examples of waiver successes, and then if you have any questions for me, I would take those. I think a lot of you might have had the chance to see the PBS documentary about a week ago, Institutions to Independence, or read the related Star Tribune article about a Washington County family that uses consumer-directed supports. And I think that's a really nice example of a success with waivered services. There's another example from Ramsey County, a young man in his late 20s who has autism and grew up in a family with a lot of abuse, and he has a DD waiver, and he's now living successfully in foster care in the community. When traditional day services didn't work for him, we worked with his residential provider to help him find and maintain employment. This is somebody with very significant disabilities that most people would have said wouldn't be able to work or live in the community, and he's been working at a local St. Paul business for over a year, making $10 an hour. So another nice success. I think that's what really drives us in our initiatives, is the whole thing about employment, people having their own job, what does that success look like, living in their own place with the supports they need, and ensuring families the support that they need to successfully care for their loved ones.
Questions? I think we'll have a bunch of questions when you all get done, so I'm kind of holding mine. So thanks, that was helpful. Hi, you can do your...
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representatives, I'm Charity Flohn. I am currently the Director of Steele County Human Services, and that's a fairly recent change for me. But I had worked in Olmsted County for a number of years, like 20 years, with the waiver program. So I'm very familiar with this particular area of community services. And I really want to say how it's really a very delightful part of human services to work with. This is an area where we're working with voluntary clients, folks who are interested in receiving services and working with us and developing plans. This is an area where we get thank you notes periodically, and I can assure you that that does not happen in all areas of community services. So it's been a very fun area to work in. As Andrea said, you know, Ramsey County has 6,000 waiver clients. In Steele County, we are at about 625. So in terms of scale, we're a much smaller, more rural community. And that's divided between developmental disabilities waiver, where we have 220, our CADI and TBI waivers, the disability groups, we're at about 99, almost 100 there. And our aging services, elderly waiver and alternative care, we're at about 315. So it's kind of split between the various programs. What the county's role in this process is a number of different things. We're responsible at the moment for contracting with the providers that are available in our community to implement the care plan, as Andrea was talking about. So we've got a role in establishing the providers, contracting with them, implementing that, doing the quality assurance. Now, you heard last week from the Department of Human Services staff that there's an initiative, their PEPSI initiative, which is the Provider Enrollment Provider Standards Initiative, to have the state kind of taking over that contracting. I've been a member of that work group for the last 18 months, and I think there's a lot of very positive things coming out of that. There are a lot of questions, too, in terms of what is the role of the county going to be as that moves forward. Who's going to be the one on the spot taking a look and checking in with some of the providers? Part of what we do now in our contracting role with the county is that provider relations kind of thing. We meet with the providers regularly, let them know kind of what's happening, how are we working together, what issues are they coming up with. We're kind of running interference sometimes if they're not getting paid or the authorizations aren't coming through. So we have a very active role in that provider relationship. We also wind up refereeing between providers sometimes in terms of that provider's taking all of my clients, you know, some of the back and forth kinds of things that happen. In responding to, you know, they're identifying a need, we've got clients that are asking for this kind of services, how do we fit that into the menu of services that we have available? So the state taking over the contracting, I think, has some advantages, but it has some potential drawbacks. You know, what if they're contracting with a provider that we're not really comfortable using? How is that going to be resolved? Where are we in that process? And I know those are questions that we've been addressing in that PEPSI group as well, so waiting to kind of see how that will all play out. As Andrea talked about, the case management role is one of the primary things that we do at the local level. We work with either public health nurses or social workers are going out and working with each individual client. The care plan is developed, as Andrea said, after that initial assessment. And sometimes we are fortunate that there's strong family support. They're active, engaged, and working very closely with this particular client. And the role of the case manager might be a little bit more, you know, restricted or limited because they've got good supports. We have other folks where they don't necessarily have good, strong family support, don't have any family support, potentially. In our elderly population, we sometimes refer to those as, you know, orphaned elderly. Their case manager might be their really only contact in a lot of areas. So there's a lot of time that's invested in working with individuals. And that sometimes is a county cost. I mean, depending on which waiver program somebody is in, the reimbursement for that case management varies, or the limits vary. But the needs don't necessarily stop at that point. So for the time that we're able to bill up to the cap, we're reimbursed. If the client is needing services and time and effort beyond that, that gets absorbed at the county level. So there are costs associated with that. The other thing that we struggle with in the outstate area is there's the regional hubs. You know, both Rochester and in Owatonna, you know, they are somewhat larger communities in the outstate area, so services are concentrated there. So we have an influx of folks moving from the surrounding counties where maybe they don't have resources, and that puts a greater strain on the case management functions and services in that home county. If we've got people moving in because we have the services, we have to take a look at, do we have the capacity to add that person in our case management mix? We have to take a look at every client that moves in that goes on a medical assistance, that's a financial services case, and that becomes a social services case. So the impact of that movement between counties is significant. In Steele County, in 2006, we had 105 assisted living beds. We are now at 496. You know, so we've had a tremendous increase in the number of assisted living beds, but we have not had a corresponding increase of that magnitude in our elderly population. That is drawing people in from the surrounding communities as well, and so that has an impact. The financing of the waivers also differs significantly depending on which waiver program they're on. Developmental disabilities has a different funding stream and mechanism in terms of allocating costs and slots. The CADDY-CAC and TBI is yet a different one and different rules and regulations there. I mean, the DD waiver has had severe restrictions on the number of slots for a number of years. You know, it's minimal. The number of slots, I think Alex talked about that last time. You know, there's like six slots available a month. CADDY-TBI is a little bit more open, so we have ability to have new people move on the program a little bit more easily. The other variable there is for a person with a developmental disability, that's essentially a lifelong diagnosis. That doesn't necessarily change. Under the CADDY-CAC TBI, you may have someone who is eligible for the services maybe for a shorter period of time as they are recovering from some significant injury or something. We've had people go on and off of that program more so than developmental disabilities. And then, of course, our elderly waiver program, there's a great deal of turnover in that particular population. We may have folks on the services for a number of years. We've had them on for as few as a few days, depending on where they are at when they come to our attention in terms of needing services. So the availability of those services varies depending on the waiver program. The dollars available depends on the waiver program, how much money you have to spend. So it depends a lot on where you are and which of those particular services. Another variable that has been playing out recently is our contracting with the health plans. A number of the health plans contract with counties to do the case management for particularly the elderly waiver program. And to some degree, the special needs basic program, we're interacting with them for our disability waivers. And the health plans have a different set of rules and regulations about how these programs need to be implemented. They have a different funding mechanism or payment mechanism with the counties as well. So it's become more and more complex over these last several years. There are changes, of course, in the paperwork and the requirements always for these various programs. Again, Department of Human Services last week talked about the Minnesota Choices, their new electronic web-based assessment tool that they're going to roll out here, hopefully in the next year or so. I think there's a tremendous benefit to that particular assessment. You know, it's standardized. It's going to be the same across all areas. The challenges for a small rural county is it's, again, a web-based tool. That means I've got to have laptops for all of my staff. I've got to have internet access for all of my staff. And in some areas of Minnesota, internet access is not consistent. But, you know, we're going to need to take laptops out so that, you know, in terms of keeping up with the technology, there are challenges and costs that are going to be associated with that as well. And I think for some of our clients, that's going to be kind of exciting to, you know, have them come in with laptops. But some of our folks are going to be a little bit not so sure about how that's going to play out. So it'll be an interesting dynamic as we get moved into that direction. Let me see, where am I at? And I think in terms of other costs and associated with the county doing this, as I said, you know, for every waiver case we open, there's a corresponding financial services case, so there's added responsibility there. For particularly as folks are moving into the county, that adds burden on our adult protection staff as well in terms of meeting the needs and the services of folks that are needing to do that. So I think those are some of the highlights that I wanted to cover. I think Andrew and I are open to questions that you may have.
Well, thanks, and we could spend the whole week on this topic and be the better for it. And we have about 12 minutes left. Can you talk about variation between counties and how they'll award services to a client of similar needs, how it varies from one county to the next? Whichever one of you would like to.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, Representatives, if you heard Andrea talk about, they have a very specific format and a process that they're doing in a larger county where they've got a little bit more resources and far more people to be served. In Steele County, the staff meet on a regular basis. I think they have a waiver team meeting every week to kind of review where are we at with resources, how are we going to allocate those. I think I mentioned I've got 26 people on the DD waiver at the moment, and I think I've got like five on the CADDYCAC TBI waiver. So it's a matter of who has the most pressing need, how long has somebody been on the waiting list, what are the potentials for someone to be maybe placed outside the area. You know, if we don't do something with some services now, is it likely that they'll have to be potentially relocated because the service is elsewhere? So it's a mix of how well do we know the client? And again, we work with these clients over a long period of time. So get to know them, get to know their families and their support system, and kind of take all of that into account as we're looking at, we've got an open slot, who is going to benefit the most from that. So it varies. I think each county has a slightly different approach. But
let me take a different crack at it. Ms. Zuber, so you have and I know that the goal is to have standardized assessment, which is something that we all wish could be, just to make sure people are correctly served, not overserved or underserved. As you look at what you have developed in Ramsey County, and as you chat with your colleagues across the state, do you notice that Ramsey County, have you found the right size of service that you seem like you're about par? Are you lower or higher service-wise?
Mr. Chair,
per person?
Representatives, I would say that we have done some studying and looking at how other counties are allocating their fundings and how closely it's in line with what we've done. So we developed our own methodology to allocate funds for the DD waiver. And then, for example, there's another large metro county that developed their own tool. There's a large northern county that developed their tool. And then the state brought in a contractor about, I think it was maybe 4 or 5 years ago, JVGA, to look at how we could allocate funds more the same across the counties. And we ran, say, one person and what their assessed needs were through all of the tools that we know of that are out there. And they came out actually really pretty close. I don't know that all counties have a method of allocating funding like that, though.
And so then that's a paper and pen tool, or is it electronic, or how do you do it, Ms. Zuber?
Mr. Chair, Representatives, it is actually computerized. It's it's based on the DD screening document has like 50 areas of assessed need, and then each of those areas has a score, a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So there's a matrix and there's a formula, and it's all run through a computer program. So if you score this much need in this area, you end up with a score at the end, and then your funds allocate to that.
Yeah, and I would like that to be done everywhere yesterday, you know. So maybe you can talk about that. Has anybody else got a question? Can you talk about the cost? Like, some of these DD waiver individuals will have $65,000 a year or so. And I mean, can you talk about the average cost, what they do, and like that? This is the Finance Committee, so just if you can cover a little bit about that. Either one of you, would maybe both.
Well, in the material that Alex Bartolo from DHS handed out last week, they did talk about the DD waiver, for instance. Statewide, there's 14,000 people being served at an average cost of $5,673 per month, whereas a CADDY program, fewer people serve, the cost there is $2,294 per month. Traumatic brain injury waiver was $5,883 per month. So the TBI and the DD waiver are much closer together. The CAC program, which again is for people that are at risk of hospitalization, it's $5,364 per month. So there's the DD waiver, the TBI waiver, and the CAC waiver are, you know, within a couple hundred dollars a piece. The CADDY waiver is you know, like $3,000 less per month. So it depends on which waiver program they're
sure.
on.
And so if you've set up care plan for somebody, and then they're happy and give the money, then everybody's happy. What if they think it wasn't quite a good enough program and they do an appeal? What happens in those situations? Maybe Ms. Zuber, you can talk about what Ramsey does, and we can hear about what Steele does. How's that?
Mr. Chair, representatives, yes, we would. If we assessed somebody's needs and allocated their funds at a level that we thought was appropriate to meet their needs, and that individual or the family thought that that wasn't enough, there is a formal appeals process, and they submit an appeal through DHS, and then there's a judge, and we hear that.
And how often do you do that? How often is, what percentage get appealed? 10%, 50%?
Mr. Chair, representatives, very, very few appeals. We have a handful a year, and I don't have those numbers with me, but it's very few.
Is that true of Steele County then, too?
Mr. Chair, representative, certainly in my experience in Olmsted County previously, I would agree the appeals are really very infrequent. It's a matter of if there's a service and they're not eligible for it or they're not qualifying, they may appeal that. On the elderly waiver and alternative care program, we have a very fixed cap that we can't exceed. So that one's a little bit more, you know, concrete in that we can't exceed, you know, the $3,400 a month or whatever the case mix cap for that individual may be. So there's not, it's, we can add that service, but we'd have to cut something else. So, you know, there's a, it's a more finite scenario. But under the disability waivers, there's a little bit more flexibility. So I think the appeals, from my experience in Olmsted County, would have been more frequent in the disability waivers. But again, infrequent.
Sure. I don't want to monopolize this. Other questions from Representative Fritz?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my question actually goes back to, the new social service director from my county, Steele County. Nice to meet you.
Hello.
And welcome.
It's a great county.
Yes, welcome. When you have someone who is on the list to receive a waiver for a certain length of time, how long is it until then social services, would then assist them with moving to another county to receive care or that waiver? I have, and I will tell you, it's a loaded question. I do have constituents who have been waiting 7, 8, and 10 years in Rice County, the other part of my district, for a waiver.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Representative,
yeah. Go ahead.
There's not like a magic number in terms of how long someone might be on the waiting list. In Steele County, as they're looking at the waiting list, the 26 individuals, as I mentioned, they're looking at that on a very regular basis. Every week in waiver team, they're kind of looking to see where are we at with people. Are they receiving some services? There are services that are available to folks without being on the waiver, mm-hmm. You know, whether they're through personal care attendant services, under MA services, what other kinds of support. So we want to make sure that everyone is getting some level of service mm-hmm. as needed. And then it's a matter of again, very few slots become available. As a slot becomes available, where is the greatest need? How do we assess that? There are times when certainly Steele County residents, for instance, may be placed in a program or residential service in another area of the state because they offer a specialized kind of service that maybe not be available. So there's not necessarily a time frame or a clock that says, okay, it's been, you know, 3 months, we need to move this person. It's always a discussion with the family and the client, what makes sense, what are the reasons, you know, the options that are available. There are tough decisions that are needing to make because there's not enough resources, there's not enough dollars to make it work. So are we able to at least, you know, put something together that's going to help meet their needs in some way, shape, or form? So if there's not a concrete number, that's what you're looking for?
Well, I'm
Representative,
Mr. Chairman, I'm looking for waivers to increase the waiver program for those folks that and there should be no 5 to 7 year wait. Mm-hmm. In this area, so that's my concern. Mm-hmm. But we will meet again.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I have one more question, and I appreciate you coming. And we do have a study group on this topic, Representative Lomer, Representative Mack, and who else is on it? Representative Hosh. And so we're trying to find our way around this topic in times of budgets that, you know, are just the same challenges you face. Can you discuss case management for a little bit? I know you get paid a fee for that for various waivers, and just can you give me just a 1 minute synopsis of that? Or because you said you had a hard time, you know, getting the people enrolled, or something about managing them at the county level. But there is a case management allocation. Is that a capped amount, and you get a certain amount per person, or how is that done? You can just, both of you can kind of just share a little comment about that, and then I think that's going to be the end of our presentation.
Mr. Chair, representatives. Under the elderly waiver program, for instance, we have a case mix cap. We can't exceed that dollar amount for their entire package of service. And case management is included in there. So it's for the folks that are on a fee-for-service that are not enrolled in a health plan, we track our time and bill that in 15-minute increments up to what is budgeted in that care plan that stays within the cap. So for one individual, we might be billing an hour and a half per month for case management or as needed, or in others it may be much more extensive, again, depending on family involvement and some of those other kinds of things. So it's limited by the overall case mix cap. So it's a matter of, what do we pay for the services? Maybe they're in a residential setting. Maybe they're doing a day program. You have to factor all of those in and figure out what amount of case management you can manage in those scenarios. And the CADI and the disability service waivers, they're not as tightly limited, but they're certainly, it's again, tracked on a 15-minute unit and billed in that way, but they don't have the same cap as the elderly program does. And maybe Andrea can speak to that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I think I can tell you that in the CAT, CADI, and TBI waivers and in the DD waivers, we actually authorize a certain number of units of case management for each case manager to be able to bill off of. We average about 1.75 hours per person of case management per month, and again, bill in the 15-minute units. But it really depends on what's going on in that person's lives. So there might be a month where there's no contact. There might be a month where there's way more than 1.75 hours a month. And I think it's really just kind of an ebb and flow. Our case managers have caseloads that are in the 50s and 60s. So if you just look at the number of hours in a work week, there's not enough time for them to do much more than that. I think that's why it's averaging out at about 1.75%.
And is the are the dollars for that in the amount the county gets per individual in the pot of money that each person brings? The case management's part of that total number, or is that an add-on?
Mr. Chair, representatives, is actually an add-on for the DD waiver, but it's within their allocation for the CAT, CADI, and TBI waivers.
You've been very helpful. Any other last questions people have? I would predict that some of our members will be getting a hold of you. I appreciate coming, and thanks for coming today. So thanks. We're going to move to another topic now. And the non-emergency transportation has been a very hot topic over the years. It's it's only a hot topic if you live in this world, but it's been lots of dialogue. We have some testimony from the legislative auditor who's releasing a report today. Is it coming out? Or today is the grand release of it. And then we're here from the department in their comments about it. And we have about an hour set aside for that. And then we want to listen to Mr. Noble talk about other auditor reports they've done. We didn't invite the providers to come. We have had entire hours-long engagement with providers, and I presume there might be some more discussion later about this with them. And if there's a bill that comes forward, we can certainly talk about that. But this is kind of presenting the auditor's report, the department response. That's the scope of today. Hopefully there'll be time for questions. And welcome to the committee, Mr. Nobles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me at the table is Joe Voss, who's going to be making our first presentation on the release of our report on medical non-emergency transportation. First of all, Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for giving us time on your busy schedule to meet with you and discuss, as was said, several previously released evaluation reports from the Office of the Legislative Auditor on human service programs, and then the report we are releasing today. I want to start, Mr. Chairman and members, by stating the obvious. That is, decisions about health and human service programs are some of the most important and challenging decisions being made in government today. They are important and challenging for several reasons. First, and I think all of the things I am going to say were just said to you, and it's interesting that you had this preface to our presentation because, again, I think the testimony that you just heard put on the table for you from people who are out there in the field administering these programs, why these programs and the decisions about them are so difficult and challenging. First and most importantly, human lives, families, and communities are directly affected in very personal and profound ways. Second reason is that these programs involve a lot of money. In fact, tremendous amounts of money. And not only that, I think you are certainly well aware that expenditure growth for many of these programs has been growing and escalating significantly. In fact, and you're going to hear about this in our second presentation, in 2009, the Legislative Auditor's Office released a report that pointed out that costs for the personal care assistance program had grown 164% over a five-year period. We felt, as I think some others do, that that is simply unsustainable over time. I think another thing that makes these decisions about these programs so challenging and difficult, and why it's so difficult to administer them, is that the public and you, representing the public, first of all, expect good service, but you also expect a very high level of accountability and integrity in these programs, in part because they do affect people's lives and they are expensive. But delivering good service and achieving good, strong accountability and integrity in these programs is itself very challenging. And I think you heard every element of that in what you just heard from the two presenters. There are many layers in all of these programs. And we always start, of course, with the federal mandates and federal requirements. And then there are added to that often state requirements, both in law and rule. And then we administer these programs through our 87 counties. And you just heard that there is significant variation in the capacity of those counties to deliver these programs. And then we are typically, with these programs, dealing with a vendor community. And that, again, was brought up. And there's a good deal of variation in the capacity of vendors to deliver these programs and for the public officials involved to, again, ensure accountability and integrity. But then, of course, again, we come back to the most important element in trying to achieve good service and accountability, and that is the clients who are served. And it's good to see people in the audience here who have that experience as well. What can we do to help all of these different levels, including the clients, you as decision makers, administrators? Well, from time to time, we can go in and try and do an in-depth examination of these programs, find what works, find what isn't working well, and come back with information and recommendations to you. And over the years, I think the legislature has been very responsive to our reports. We never present to you easy answers, but you are responsive, and I think try, within the context of all of this complexity, to ensure that good, accountable services are being delivered. So we are here today to talk about yet another one of our reports in the arena of human services, medical non-emergency transportation. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Voss to make the presentation. And again, thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Joe Voss, and I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office. And I'm here to summarize our evaluation of medical non-emergency transportation. With me is David Kirshner, who also worked on this study, and behind us is Dan Jacobson, who also worked on the study and helped write the report. I'd like to start by just giving you a quick overview of what our major findings were. First, we found that the way Minnesota has organized the non-emergency transportation program, we thought the organization is somewhat duplicative and confusing. We also found that the Department of Human Services has developed very few formal written policies and guidelines regarding how the program is to be administered and how various types of decisions are to be made. Third, we found poor program monitoring and oversight on the part of the Department of Human Services. And finally, we found that hiring an outside contractor, commonly referred to as a broker, to determine program eligibility, take requests for trips, and then distribute and schedule trips among various transportation providers. We found that using a broker has reduced some transportation costs, but data limitations kept us from being able to measure whether the total savings from using a broker outweigh the total cost of having one in the first place. There's incomplete information there. So with that, let me give you just a little bit of background information on the non-emergency transportation program. First of all, it's a federal mandate. If Minnesota wants to participate in the Medicaid program, we have to provide transportation assistance to Medicaid recipients so that they can get to and home again from medical appointments. Like every other state in the nation, Minnesota has such a program, and it's under the purview of the Department of Human Services here in Minnesota. About 253,000 public assistance recipients were eligible to receive transportation assistance in fiscal year 10. The vast majority of these people were medical assistance recipients who are covered by the state's fee-for-service approach. Our study did not look at how medical assistance recipients covered by or enrolled in managed care health plans receive transportation assistance. We only looked at the fee-for-service population. In
Mr. Chair?
Fiscal year...
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I ask a question, please?
If it's just burning, go ahead.
It's burning. Okay.
Representative Murphy, what would you like to ask?
Thank you.
Now I really need to know.
Before we move on from this point, can you just talk a little bit more, or maybe you'll cover it later, what is unique about the population served in medical assistance that's paid for with fee-for-service payments? Is there something that brings that population together?
Ms. Boss.
Representative Murphy, Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that the fee-for-service medical assistance population tends to be older, tends to have more disabilities, and tend to be harder to serve than those that are typically been served in managed care health plans. The fact that we excluded the managed care health plans doesn't mean that they're not eligible for transportation assistance. They just get it through a different mechanism than the fee-for-service people. But my understanding is that the population has somewhat different needs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy did. Thanks. Keep going.
Okay. Cost of the program, fiscal year 2010, $38 million. This slide lays out how medical transportation is organized in Minnesota. In the late 1970s, the legislature created two major categories of non-emergency transportation: access transportation and special transportation. Both of these transportation programs have the same goal: to get people to and from medical appointments using the least expensive type of appropriate transportation. Access transportation programs are largely administered by counties. All medical assistance recipients are eligible to receive access transportation. The program pays mileage costs to medical assistance recipients when they drive themselves to the doctor, as well as mileage costs when friends or family or volunteers drive them. The program distributes bus passes, and it pays for MA recipients to take taxi-style vehicles to and from medical appointments. And these vehicles provide recipients with either curb-to-curb or door-to-door assistance. In contrast, special transportation is administered by the Department of Human Services. Only those medical assistance recipients who are physically or mentally unable to take access transportation are eligible for special transportation. And the department has contracted with a broker to actually determine whether or not an individual is eligible for special transportation. Once their eligibility has been established, it's up to the MA recipient to call a transportation provider when they need a ride, and it's up to them to schedule the appointment. They have to call a taxi-style transportation provider that is certified by the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And drivers of those vehicles have to offer what's called door-through-door services, in that they have to pick the recipient up inside the door actually take them through the door of their destination site and all the way up to the appointment desk of their medical provider. Now, on paper, this structure might look fairly neat, but in practice, it doesn't always work quite that way. First, healthcare needs are not static, and some MA recipients sort of flip-flop back and forth between the two types of transportation, sometimes even in the same day. For example, a recipient might be able to take a bus to a medical appointment, but because they're during the whatever procedure they're having done, they are sedated, or perhaps they're undergoing a chemotherapy session, and when they're done, they're not going to feel very well. They may need somebody to actually help them on their way home. Well, the county arranges the trip to the doctor, but it's up to the medical, to the recipient itself, to actually have called in advance and scheduled a ride home with a special transportation provider. It's also up to the recipient to actually call another party altogether, the Department of Human Services broker, to actually make sure that they're eligible for special transportation in the first place. So there are a lot of hoops that a small number of people have to go through. Furthermore, we found that many of the taxi-style providers that are used in Minnesota offer both access and special transportation. The only difference really is the amount of assistance that the driver provides to the recipient. If a driver picks up or drops off a recipient at the curb or at the front door of a building, well, that's access transportation. But if they actually take that person through the door or go through the door to get them, well, then that's special transportation. And the driver bills for the services in different ways. In addition, if the driver goes through the door to get a recipient, the vehicle that driver came in has to be certified by the Department of Transportation. But if they only come to the front door to get the person and don't actually go through the door, then the vehicle doesn't have to be certified by the Department of Transportation. Finally, some people fall between the cracks because the two categories of transportation are not well coordinated. For example, outstate counties often have problems finding appropriate access transportation providers who can transport people that are either in motorized wheelchairs or who have to be transported while seated in a wheelchair. When these MA recipients call the department's broker to try to find out if they can get a special transportation ride because there are no appropriate providers in their communities, they find out that the answer is no, they're not eligible for special transportation because they really don't need the amount of assistance that a driver might provide. Once a recipient in a motorized wheelchair gets the chair out of the vehicle, a lot of them are perfectly capable of getting themselves into the doctor's office, and they really don't need that assistance from the special transportation driver. We found that when MA recipients in these circumstances actually appealed their denial of service before administrative law judges, the judges have sometimes ruled in favor of the recipient and sometimes rule in favor of the department. So it's sort of up in the air which way it's going to fall. In terms of recommendations, we recommend that the legislature require the Department of Human Services to develop a proposal that would create a single administrative structure for Minnesota's non-emergency medical transportation program. And we would like to see that proposal presented to the 2012 legislature. We think that in developing this proposal, the department should seek input from all interested parties, including legislators. We also recommend that the legislature clarify statutes in terms of whether or in terms of MA recipients' eligibility for special transportation, especially when appropriate forms of access transportation are simply not available in their communities. The second area that we had concerns about involved what we call ad hoc decision making on the part of the Department of Human Services. Although the Department of Human Services has used a broker to determine special transportation eligibility since early 2005, we found that the department has actually developed very little written guidance on how the broker should do its job. Instead of developing formal policies and procedures, we found that the department has instead relied on verbal communications and emails. Very little is written down in a way that members of the public can actually see the rationale for the various decisions that the department is making. We also noted that the department has rarely solicited public input when it makes administrative decisions about program eligibility for special transportation. And when the department sort of changes its mind about how certain factors affect eligibility, it doesn't routinely notify the public that changes have been made. For example, until spring of 2010, it was the department's practice to not allow MA recipients who travel with personal care assistance to actually use special transportation. The rationale was that any assistance the MA recipient may need, they can get from the personal care attendant and not the driver vehicle. However, the department was criticized for this practice about a year ago, and they decided to change the policy and allow these people to use special transportation. However, it didn't notify people who were previously denied service because they traveled with a personal care attendant that the policy had changed, that they would probably now be eligible if they applied. Finally, we noted that the department's special transportation rules are quite old. They haven't been updated since 1987, and there have just been a gazillion changes in the program since then. Our recommendation in this area is to increase transparency. We think the department should develop and publish formal written policies that everyone can access and see what the department's policies are. And we think that when the department changes its policies, that interested parties should be notified. And when major changes have occurred in eligibility, they should also notify people who were previously denied services that the rules of the game have changed. We also looked at how well the department monitors the non-emergency transportation program on a statewide basis. We found that the department collects very little data on the program in terms of what's happening statewide. For example, the department does not track the number of recipients receiving access transportation in outstate counties, nor does it know anything about the number of trips provided to recipients in outstate Minnesota. We think that this makes it extremely difficult for the department to actually assess whether MA recipients are receiving appropriate services outstate. As part of our evaluation, we also looked at how well DHS monitored the broker when it contracted for access transportation services in the Twin Cities area. The department contracted for those services from the middle of July 2004 until July 2009, when the legislature told them to stop brokering access transportation. The department also contracts with the broker and continues to contract with the broker to make eligibility decisions for special transportation. So we looked at the contract, we looked at them at how they do things, and we found that the contract itself contains many monitoring tools, a number of performance measures, but we also found that the department did not really implement a formal quality assurance program that actually relied on the performance measures that were written into the contract. We found that monitoring consisted largely of frequent meetings with the broker, as well as verbal communications. We also found that the department made a number of contract-related decisions that resulted in paying the broker what we thought was probably a little bit more than necessary. We didn't find instances where payments were improper or just not right, but more or less payments that we questioned, did they have to be that much? We noted that when the 11 counties in the Twin Cities area took over the broker's contract in July of 2009, and they contracted for basically the same kinds of services that the Department of Human Services had previously contracted for, they ended up paying the broker about $2 million less in administrative fees for fiscal year 2010 than the Department of Human Services did in fiscal 2009. In terms of recommendations, we think the department needs to identify some key measures that it can use to evaluate how well non-emergency transportation programs are working on a statewide basis. And then they need to collect that information and actually report it out. We also think that the department should periodically verify the data that counties submit and the data the brokers submit, to make sure that data that are being submitted are reasonable and accurate. The fourth area that we had some questions about concerns whether or not relates to how using a broker has affected costs. Ideally, it would be really nice to come before you and say something about the overall cost effectiveness of using a broker, but I can't do that. There are just not enough data available for us to actually measure whether using a broker has actually saved more money than it's cost to have a broker in the first place. For example, when we looked at data availability, there are no data available that would tell us costs and services before the broker and after the broker. Likewise, it's impossible for us to compare the experiences of counties that don't use a broker with those that do use a broker, because the data that are collected from both kinds of counties are too vastly different. What we can tell you, though, is that in some areas, using a broker does seem to have saved some money. And I'd like to just run through one or two of those areas with you. First, since Minnesota started to use a broker to determine special transportation eligibility, we found that spending for special transportation, which provides the most costly types of services, special transportation spending has dropped, while spending for access transportation, which is generally cheaper, access transportation spending has increased. We estimated that the state saved about $400,000 a year by increasing the number or the types, increasing spending for access transportation and decreasing special transportation spending. This trend is shown kind of nicely in this slide. Special transportation spending is represented by the orange, and access transportation spending shown by the yellow. You can see that total spending has pretty much increased over the last decade, but more dollars are being spent in the lower cost categories of access transportation than in special transportation. A second area that we found that using a broker has saved some money concerns the number of miles that transportation providers are reimbursed for trips. There was a short period of time, October 2006 through January 2008, where the broker not only determined eligibility for special transportation, but they also scheduled special transportation rides. We found that during the time frame that the broker scheduled those rides, the average length of trips declined. That is, special transportation drivers drove fewer miles per trip to get MA recipients to and from their medical appointments. We estimated that this mileage reduction saved anywhere between $400,000 and $600,000 a year. And that pretty much sums up the major findings of our report. Again, these are our overall conclusions. A duplicative and confusing administrative structure. Ad hoc decision making on the part of the Department of Human Services, poor oversight, and some cost savings from using a broker. This sums up our major recommendations. We'd like to see a proposal for a single administrative structure developed. Statute should be clarified regarding special transportation eligibility, more formal written policies and procedures, more notification to the public about changes in practices, and better data collection. We also have other recommendations besides these, and those can be found on page 67 of our report. I might also draw your attention to the Department of Human Services response to our evaluation. It's on page 69 of our report. And with that, I will take questions. I know the department is here to...
They're going to come down in a minute. The Representative Fritz has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you for this report. I think I was one of the legislators that requested this audit. And I'm very happy that it's in front of us, and it certainly does tell the story that many of us in greater Minnesota were trying to relay to the body. And speaking of greater Minnesota, I would like to ask about two questions, and that is the involvement of my providers in greater Minnesota. I have RNS Transport, the Elwood family, that has done an outstanding job down in Rice County, going down into Rochester. Representative Lieblings and Representative Norton also has the Elwood family, the RNS, and also Mankato. There are a couple of providers here today from the Mankato area as well. And I want to know that in your report, that the department will be meeting directly with those providers in the very near future. And I would definitely want to work on this legislation. But I want to be I want us to be a collaborative effort on the part of the department and the providers and the clients and the legislature. And is that in your report?
That is.
Ms. Voss.
That is, Representative, Mr. Chairman, that is what we would like to see when we suggest that, when we recommend that that the legislature require the department to develop a proposal. We would like to see that proposal developed with input from all interested parties. And I think having a legislative representation on during that process would only help.
And Mr. Chair, and a follow-up, and I can ask the department, I'm sure I'll get that chance, that opportunity here today as well, but also on the NOLOT. You know, in greater Minnesota, I heard so many times from the Elwoods that they would go to Kenyon to pick someone up that's east of my, and the hospital is located in Faribault, District 1. And you know, in the middle of the night, and it's just, I know an overtime driver, and then not really get compensated. I mean, I don't know how they stayed in business. I really don't. And I'm thankful that they did. And I wondered about the, you know, the no load, or when the vehicle was nobody in it, and they're driving back and forth and putting in 4 to 6 hours at night. Is there a provision for that, for payment for that?
Ms. Voss.
Mr. Chair, Representative, Medicaid rules do not allow the department to use, or counties to use, Medicaid funds to pay either volunteers or transportation providers for that period of time or those miles driven when there's no recipient, no MA recipient in the vehicle. Those are called no-load miles. Mm-hmm. That doesn't prevent the state or the county from using money from other pots to reimburse for those no-load miles. I know we did a survey of county human service directors, and I know that it's probably the number one problem that outstate counties have, is that a lot of them rely on volunteers to actually transport medical assistance recipients to doctor's appointments. And they have a hard time finding volunteers if they can't pay for those empty miles that they drive simply to pick somebody up. And I know they are greatly concerned about the fact that they cannot use Medicaid dollars for that. And with budgets getting tighter, they're having a hard time finding other pots of money. We do have a recommendation in that respect that we have on page 58, and we ask that the department develop alternative reimbursement methods to help compensate at least volunteers in outstate Minnesota, where I think the problem is greater than in the metropolitan area, to address the whole issue of no-load miles, because that's just becoming more and more of a problem in outstate.
And Ms. Voss, we set the rates, right? Mileage and trip rates, are those in the statute?
Mr. Chair, the rates for special transportation providers are set in statute. The legislature also set some of the reimbursement rates for access transportation. They set the mileage reimbursement rate for volunteers, for recipients driving themselves.
Yeah.
The rates for access transportation, taxi-style service providers, those are set by the Department of Human Services.
And those are subject to a federal match then, right? So we, it's half state, half federal. Generally, whatever they get comes half from us and half from the feds.
In general, the feds pick up about half the tab for the program. It's changed a little bit with the federal stimulus money coming in.
Yeah,
but
that.
In general, the feds pick up about half the cost.
Well, thanks. Won't we have the department come down? And you can stick around because we'll come back at the end and finish our 20 minutes more on this topic with a panel discussion, if it gets to that, or if members have questions. And members, especially the freshmen, you'll be getting, we'll be talking about other reports. These reports are generally quite sound, and nobody agrees with everything all the time, but their work is well respected. These reports are only as good as people who read them. The legislative auditor can advise, the governor can propose, the auditor advises, but the final disposition of any action is up to interested legislators to dig in and make something of it. Well, welcome to the committee, Mr. Assistant Commissioner. Is that right?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Scott Leitz, Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to respond to the legislative auditor's report, and in particular thank the auditor's office for its very thorough and comprehensive report. Ms. Voss, Mr. Jacobson, and Mr. Kirshner also for their very professional work during this process. What I'm going to do is give a very high-level response to the report and then ask Chris Reisdorf, who's at the table with me, to walk through our more detailed response. In short, DHS very much welcomes these findings. As the incoming administration, we have a top priority on ensuring services are delivered efficiently and effectively to the clients that we serve. With dwindling resources, we have an obligation to do our work and deliver those services as efficiently and well as we possibly can. And we plan to use this report to improve on our oversight and implementation of this program. Medical non-emergency transportation can be a challenging service to manage. As the report points out, rates and services vary by region and by medical necessity. Further, the authority to manage these services is divided among counties in the state. Because of this complexity, we agree that changes can and should be made to improve the program, as well as to improve the oversight and implementation of it. I'm going to close with sort of three areas that I just want to mention that we think are overriding themes, and then I'll turn it over to Ms. Reisdorf. The first is that medical non-emergency transportation is an important service provided to Medicaid enrollees. As is outlined briefly in the report, medical non-transportation is a federally mandated benefit that enables Medicaid recipients to access approved health-related services. States are required to make non-emergency medical transportation available to Medicaid beneficiaries to assure their access to medically necessary services. Medical transportation services vary, but can be generalized as the least expensive, appropriate, and available mode of transport. The program's purpose is really to help lower overall medical costs and improve patient outcomes by enabling Medicaid recipients to receive routine preventive care, which will keep them from needing more expensive services down the road. In short, providing transportation assistance for routine care helps control non-emergency and emergency health care costs and improves client outcomes. Secondly, requiring that a service is medically necessary and that an objective level of need assessment is completed limits overuse of the service. We did see in the past that billing and use of special transportation services were increasing, and when we required the statements to be submitted for review, we discovered that a significant number of people receiving special transportation services did not require the level of need of service that they were receiving. So nurses provided through the contract with MTM review medical necessity before providing special transportation levels of services. This review ensures that DHS abides with the federal requirement to provide non-emergency transportation assistance to the nearest qualified provider for covered services using the least expensive type of appropriate transportation. Finally, we want to work with the legislature to set stable and consistent policy in this area. In the past, there have been multiple changes to the program, and at times that has made it somewhat difficult to assess whether some of the efforts that either the agency or the legislature has asked us to undertake have actually been effective. And so we're looking forward to using the auditor's report as a way to improve the program and to work with the legislature to really improve both the overall operation of the program as well as its ability to deliver services to our clients. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Ms. Reisdorf.
Hello, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Chris Reiser from the Department of Human Services. You have a handout that I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but just highlight a few things on it. It's the handout that I'm referring to. It says Health and Human Services Finance Committee. And as the first thing on it says background. And I'm just going to talk about several of the recommendations that the auditors had for us. Maybe first of all, though, maybe clarifying for you, this audit looked at fee-for-service MA, medical transportation services. Essentially, those are people who are under 665 and disabled are the people who receive fee-for-service medical assistance services. So the background, I think you probably have a number of things that has been brought up, the two types of non-emergency medical transportation, the ATS type and the STS type of transportation. So I'm just going to kind of move into maybe the first recommendation that they had, and the department welcomes this recommendation wholeheartedly. I think that we know that the current system is confusing and inconsistent, that the counties manage some services, DHS manages some other services, the contractor manages some other services. And so we do plan to bring forward a proposal to bring a group of people together to bring something to this body in 2012 with a what they're calling a coordinated system for the non-emergency medical transportation service. I think groups that we would like to bring together are, of course, include counties, Metropolitan Council, Area on Aging, Mental Health Professionals, Minnesota Council on Disabilities, Providers, MnDOT, and elected officials, and perhaps others can come together and help develop a single administrative process for this very complex and confusing type of service. And I think that if we can get into a coordinated system, the result will be increased access, cost effectiveness, and accountability. I think the next one that I'm going to maybe highlight is on the second page. It's the second recommendation there that says routinely publish special transportation eligibility policies. I just want to comment that the STS service is a service that requires authorization. No different than back surgery or some radiology services. It's a service that's based on medical necessity on a case-by-case basis. So it is difficult to put out specific criteria under which we authorize this service. However, we will work with our contractor to see if we can make that process more transparent. But I just wanted to comment that this is a medical necessity review on a case-by-case basis. And so there are people who cognitively and physically cannot get themselves from inside their residence to the desk of the provider. And that's a very kind of an individual determination. Yeah, the second one is the last one on that page that has come up, the issue of the no-load miles. We know that has been a concern for many counties, and that volunteers have to drive out to the person's home and bring them to the provider and then bring back to the home and back to their own home. So there are a number of miles that they cannot bill for because we can only reimburse miles when the client is in that vehicle. One thing that we have proposed, and actually the federal government has proposed, is to increase the rate that we pay per mile to volunteers. The rate that we pay volunteers is connected to the IRS rate. Right now it's 51 cents a mile. Compare that to what we pay a person who drives their own car, which is 20 cents a mile. So that's pretty low. But they get 51 cents a mile. So what we can do is work with people to draft something, give some technical assistance to, so that we can increase. That's one possible solution to this, is increase the rate that we pay volunteers on a per mile basis to help compensate for the fact that they are driving miles that they cannot bill for. Maybe the last one that I'll highlight is the first one on the last page. And I think this is something that we have been concerned with also. I think the auditors commented that most of the ATS services are managed and coordinated by the counties, and they bill us in a bundled fashion. In other words, they bill us the total number of personal miles that they reimburse for that month, or total number of taxi-type miles, and is not broken out by client or date. And so we are moving forward working with the counties to change the way that they bill us for these services, so that they will be billing us for services based on client and date specific information, so that we can analyze the ATS services on a statewide basis and get down to such things as how many what's the distance traveled, the number of trips that each client takes, that sort of thing. So we look forward to implementing a lot of the things that the auditors have recommended. Again, I think the primary one that we are looking forward to is kind of a revamping of this whole process. It has been a long time since any changes have been made as far as the types of services. I think we have not brokered. Now that currently the eight metro counties are contracting with MTM to broker the ATS services. So I think an opportunity to bring this all together and have one kind of service, or one kind of method of looking at the services, managing this service into one coordinated system, will be a very positive outcome.
Thank you, Ms. Riesdorf. I have a question, at least there's one member question. On this, the counties got a better deal. Was that because they had a more interested vendor who had lost everything and wanted to get something back, or did they find the right price, or can you comment about that?
Mr. Chair, members, I think that's the contracting that happened in between the counties and the
right.
So I'm not sure. I think that they were able to obviously get a lower cost, because they are paying. It's a kind of an apples and oranges kind of a thing, because we were paying on a per trip basis, and the counties are paying with a trip plus an admin fee. So it's a different way of paying for that brokering service also.
All right. Representative McDonald.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. You're up.
Yes. Actually, it was a question for Ms. Voss, but perhaps...
Okay. Well, maybe you want to bring the auditor folks back, and we can just have a little panel there.
And it was just a quick question, of course.
Yeah. Sorry, didn't
you? Should I ask it?
Yeah, sure. There's room. Oh, yeah, Scott's going to bail. So, yeah, we'll have the two of you sit there. Mr. Lights is going to bail. So.
Quick question, Ms. Voss, yeah. Perhaps a quick answer. I'm just curious. We know that you served about 253,000 recipients, and were billed at per mileage. Just curious as to how many miles were logged in fiscal year 2010.
Ms. Voss.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's one piece of information that's not collected currently. In the Twin Cities area, I think we have data on the number of miles that are driven, but the department does not collect data on trips in outstate Minnesota, so we really don't know anything about, in total, how many miles are traveled for the entire program.
Professor McDonald.
Mr. Chair. Ms. Voss, thank you. But we're billed at, what is it, 51 cents a mile? Is that what the reimbursables are? So how do we...
Mr. Chair, it depends on what kind of transportation you're getting, if you're getting access transportation or special transportation. And then within each of those categories, it depends on the type of transportation you're taking. If you are driving yourself to the doctor, you are paid a rate of 20 cents a mile. If you have a volunteer taking you, you are now paid 51 cents. The volunteer is paid 51 cents a mile. If you have, if you use a bus, you get bus money. If you take a special type vehicle, depending on the level of service, the fee ranges anywhere, I think, from about $10 to $13 base rate and another $1.35 per mile. And then if you are taking a special transportation vehicle, the rates are slightly higher than that. So it depends on the type of transportation you're getting.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, just lastly then, and I'll close. How do we know how much to pay if we don't know how many miles were driven?
Ms. Voss.
There are two representative. When outstate counties bill the department, they just submit a great big bill in terms of this is how much we spent on personal mileage, this is how much we spent for bus passes, and the department just reimburses them that total amount. In the Twin Cities area, the broker actually submits data for individual trips. They will tell the department how many miles they traveled, and the department will figure out, well, they drove 9.6 miles at a rate of $11 base rate and an additional $1.35 per mile. This is how much we're paying. Special transportation providers do the same thing. They bill the state, and they indicate the number of miles they drove, and then the state pays the proper mileage. Did I get that right?
I think that's good for now. Representative McDonald sounds like he's volunteering for the work group. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I just wanted to ask Ms. Riesdorf, is it the timeline of getting together to continue this and to form some legislation and to bring back this committee that I did serve on in the beginning of that of the task force of this? And would be willing to serve again. I just wanted to put myself out there and just ask you what the timeline is to get something together for the legislature.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we plan on having part of our legislative proposal to the development of an advisory committee to help us work through this. And I think that we're looking at having this plan submitted to the 2012, January of 2012. So we don't have a timeline at this point. I mean, we will be proposing this in our policy proposals, and I think that as soon as this passes, I would suspect that we'll probably be getting some group together late spring, early summer, somewhere in there, to go through what other states are doing, compare Minnesota to other states, and see if we can. You hammer out kind of a single administrative process for this service.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you. And a follow-up to that is that I would like the providers from Greater Minnesota that are my constituents to participate in that as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we will certainly want outstate providers represented on this committee.
Representative Fritz, it will come before your committee, so you'll have a chance to fix it up for them if they. Representative Gottwald gets maybe the last question.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Actually, just a brief comment. This isn't meant to be a beat-up on DHS comment necessarily, but it is a bit distressing looking through this information and seeing that, millions of dollars in overpayment because of lack of oversight and poor data collection and I recall we toured the MTM, the broker, 3 years ago, I think, and went over some issues that were deep concerns in these same areas. And, you know, every dollar is precious when we're trying to deliver these services to people who need them. And I just hope that we see some real changes. And maybe one question for the auditor's office is, do we follow up then with these recommendations from an auditor perspective and check to see that they've been improved from their perspective? Or
Ms. Voss.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what we do is a year later or so, and probably before around the time the session starts next year, we generally will have contacted the department, found out what they've done since the report came out, what remains to be done, and we prepare what we call impact papers, and we distribute those to legislators during the next session. So we will be following up on any changes that have taken place. We won't be doing another evaluation or anything, but we do follow up.
Well, I think this is very productive, and I think just for, you know, the audience and members, this is a relatively small. You can come down, Mr. Nobles. We're going to shift to the next presentation. Thank you, Ms. Riesdorf. How we manage and serve the individuals one at a time affects a lot of people individually, and some of the impacts are very remarkable, both good and bad. And so this is one of those kind of topics that you can just see firsthand with people you might know that had a challenge. So. And we serve some 800,000 people in various ways. This is how we touch a good number of them. So I will watch for that recommendation to come forward. And I would suppose the speaker would appoint the members of that. We could specify your name in the legislation, Representative Fritz, maybe, just to make sure you're... Mr. Nobles is going to shift gears a little bit and talk about some past work that they've done. And so welcome back and...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, my name is Jim Nobles, legislative auditor, and with me at the table now is Joel Alter. And Representative Gottwald's question was very apropos and a good way to transition to look at some previous evaluation reports we've done in the area of human services and to give you some very brief highlights on what has happened and, unfortunately, in some cases, what has not happened. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to call on Mr. Alter.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Joel Alter with the Auditor's Office. And as Jim mentioned, our office has done a lot of work at Human Services over the years. We've done financial audits, which I'm not going to talk about today, but we've also done a fair number of program evaluations. And I think what we'll do today will maybe just kind of whet your appetite for some of the work that we've done. I'm going to start with just a list of reports that we've had out in the past 5 years that are related to human services, and you'll note that one of these at the top of the list is actually one that's going to be coming out in about a month. That report will address the civil commitment of sex offenders to facilities operated by DHS. Sometimes we've had people who come to us and they say, you know, can't you just go and take a look at the entire agency top to bottom? And I think it's good to remind ourselves, and we've certainly done that today in the previous presentations, that DHS is a big place, and the programs it administers are very complicated. 6,500 full-time equivalent employees at DHS. And so typically what we do when we do evaluations is to look at DHS one program at a time, as was described in the previous study that we looked at. And even within those programs, there are often numerous rules, laws, many stakeholders, complex relationships that involve the federal government, the counties, and vendors. Because of that, I'm just going to touch today on a few highlights from some past studies. And I'm going to talk first about a study that we issued in 2007. And this was, an exception to what I just said. Usually we look at DHS one program at a time. But we did a study that looked kind of across programs and was a big picture look at a system that is often described as a state-supervised, county-administered human services system. And I want to highlight today just a few issues that came out of that report that I think are still out there and not sufficiently addressed at this time. One of the issues that came out of that report was the complexity of healthcare eligibility requirements and across programs such as Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance. We noted growing complexity, typically resulting from state laws for these multiple programs, and that complexity has both reduced administrative efficiency as well as increasing the risk of noncompliance. And to address these issues that we raised in that report, the 2009 legislature required DHS to come back by September 2010 with recommendations on ways to align the medical assistance and the Minnesota care programs, particularly related to eligibility requirements. DHS did hire a consultant, the Lewin Group. They came back with a preliminary report in September of 2010. To my knowledge, I'm not aware that DHS has, at this point, offered any recommendations to the legislature. The consultant's report did, in fact, confirm what we had said in 2007, that, in fact, the differences in the eligibility requirements caused what they called confusion, delay, administrative expense, and error. And they said that the goal of aligning eligibility for these programs is, quote, more important than ever. So I think where we stand today on that is there's still work to be done, and it would be appropriate, particularly with the new administration, to see what they can recommend going forward. A second unresolved issue from that 2007 report is the issue of trying to assess responsibility and where it should rest for various human services programs. There could be transfers of responsibility from the counties to DHS or vice versa. And in our 2007 report, we made some preliminary identification of some areas where it might make sense to consider transfers in areas such as adoption services, child support enforcement, child care licensing, and others. And the 2007 legislature required DHS to report by January 2009 on the need for such transfers. They also, the legislature also set up an advisory committee to assist DHS in that respect. Based on our contacts with DHS last year, that report was never prepared, and to my knowledge, the advisory committee has been inactive for the past 2 years. So I think the message here is that, to our knowledge, there has not been progress on this kind of sorting out of what the proper locus of responsibility is for some of those areas where there were questions. And then finally, we said in our 2007 report that at least certain counties should redesign their human services administrative arrangements. There are some very small counties trying to do some very big jobs in human services. Presently, only 5 of the 87 counties in Minnesota are engaged in some sort of a multi-county administrative arrangement, and that number has not changed since the 1970s. We recognize that any type of redesign at the county level is not going to be a panacea for improving service delivery. It may not even save large amounts of money, but I think as we consider ways to make the human services dollar go farther, this is one of those topics that I think keeps coming up, and it certainly has been discussed a lot, but not a lot of action since our report. I want to shift gears and say a few words about a report that we issued in 2009 on personal care assistance. This is a program that's largely funded out of federal and state Medicaid dollars. It's a very important service for people who have health care problems and are trying to remain in their homes. But at the same time, we saw enormous cost growth in this program in the years leading up to our study. We said that PCA services were very loosely regulated, to the point where, in our view, both the service quality and the financial integrity of this program were threatened. So among the things that happened in the wake of our 2009 report, as we recommended, the legislature passed training requirements that pertain to individual PCAs as well as to the agencies that employ them. We observed in our report that many clients were choosing to opt out of periodic supervision of services by professionals such as nurses or social workers. And as we recommended, such supervision is now a requirement in law. It's no longer just an option. We said that DHS should provide additional guidance to people who conduct client assessments, and DHS has done that. Also, starting in 2011, the assessors are required by law to be state certified. Our 2009 report raised a lot of questions about the potential in this program for fraud and abuse, and we noted that DHS had not implemented adequate controls to prevent overpayment. For example, we discussed instances in which DHS had made payments for more than 24 hours of service by an individual PCA in a day. And when our report came out, DHS assured us that they had recently taken action to put some controls in place that would address those types of overpayments. We did a financial audit last year, and we found that those controls in many cases were not yet working effectively. So at least up until about mid-2010, there were still issues, hopefully, that have since been addressed by DHS. And then finally, we said in 2009 that the recent rate of cost increases in the PCA program was not sustainable. We didn't recommend specific ways to try to bring down the cost of the program, but the 2009 legislature did implement a variety of eligibility restrictions. And I think these have been the topic of a lot of discussion and debate. Some of those restrictions are going to go into place later this year, and so I think the discussion is not over, and those will be certainly worth monitoring over time. For the other reports our office has issued, I want to just briefly touch on a few highlights, and I'll do that very quickly because I know we're running short of time, but I'll touch on a few things that, again, may just whet your appetite. We issued a report in 2008 on the financial management of Minnesota's publicly funded health care programs. There had been questions at the outset of our study raised about whether or not the managed care model that Minnesota had kind of slowly grown into for its public programs was reasonable. And what we reported is there was mixed evidence on cost effectiveness of managed care, but in our view, this approach provided a stronger mechanism for leveraging improvements in healthcare costs than did fee-for-service care. On the other hand, we pointed out that Minnesota's managed care spending per enrollee had actually been growing in the previous years at a rate faster than the national average. So we suggested that DHS needed to essentially drive a harder bargain in its negotiations. We issued a report in 2007 looking at eligibility determinations for the Minnesota CARE program. We found that there were serious problems with the accuracy of eligibility decisions, and these had persisted over a period of time. DHS, even prior to our report, had initiated development of an automated system that you may have heard of called Health Match. It was intended to improve the accuracy of eligibility determinations. Development of that system took a lot longer and, frankly, was never completed. The length of time it was taking was due both to missteps by DHS and by the contractor it hired. And in 2008, the year after we issued our report, DHS terminated the contract with the vendor. Since that time, DHS has been in litigation with the contractor, and DHS officials recently told us that until that litigation is resolved, they will be unable to proceed with the replacement system for Health Match. So I think this is not a good story. It's basically a system that was originally intended to be in place in 2005. Here we are in 2011, and we're still really at the pretty early stages of it. A couple other highlights I'll touch on. In 2006, we did a study of county eligibility decisions for health care involving non-citizens. This can be a very complicated type of determination to make, and we found that there are a lot of errors in these determinations. In the majority of cases that we reviewed, there was some sort of an error, and in 20% of the cases we reviewed, there was an error that actually affected or would have affected the eligibility for benefits. We did a review of substance abuse treatment in 2006, the programs that are administered by DHS. We said there was mixed evidence regarding the cost effectiveness of substance abuse treatment, even though you'll often hear people say on the one hand, treatment works, and you'll hear people on the other hand say nothing works, and the truth in our view is somewhere in the middle, as we discussed in more detail in that report. We also pointed out that in our view, DHS had not done enough oversight to ensure that placements and referrals, which are done at the county level, were being done consistently, and we also noted that some types of treatment were in short supply. And finally, we did a study in 2006 on child support enforcement. We said that Minnesota's program performed well on four of the federal government's five performance measures. At that time, it did not rank very well compared with other states on the other measure, which was a measure of cost effectiveness. That is, how much money is collected compared to the cost of administering the services. And we also found the county administration of child support enforcement was inconsistent around the state. And after our report, I know the DHS started some efforts to try to improve practices among counties, although we haven't done a detailed follow-up study of that. And I would only add, maybe in closing, that this is the time of year when the Legislative Audit Commission, which directs our work, begins to look for topics for new evaluations by our office. Generally, they solicit those topics from members of the legislature and others. And so as issues come up during the session, as ideas come to you individually, I know our office and the Audit Commission would welcome any ideas if there are human services programs or other types of programs that need a closer look. Feel free to let our office know, or this year the Audit Commission is being chaired by Representative Michael Beard. Thank you very much.
Just to point out, the auditor got done at 30 seconds to spare, so that's how good they are. They and for the newer members, their work is highly credible, and we need to look at some of these. There's a, if you want any of these reports, there are hard copies available, and if you just ask Andy or somebody, you can get a list of who wants whatever. Tomorrow we look at PCAs and other things. So, any last comments? Thanks for coming. We're adjourned. Well, happy Bemidji Day, by the way. So, yeah.